Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carriad Lloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
the Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carriad's Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you. This week's book guest is You Are Not Alone by Carriad Lloyd. And this episode was recorded live at Foyles on Tottenham Court Road. What's it about? Well, it's a book about death and grief, but cheerier than that sounds. In 2016, Carriad created the Griefcast podcast, where she spoke to comedians about their experiences of life and death. After interviewing nearly 200 people, she decided to write down everything she'd learned from this raw, heartfelt and funny conversations to help remind anyone grieving that they are, in fact, not alone.
What qualifies it for the Weirdos Book Club? Well, it's written by me. I'm one of the original weirdos and it gets automatic entry into the club.
In this episode, we discuss
mums,
acting,
writing with pain,
selfies in graveyards
and Joni Mitchell.
Trigger warning, in this episode, we do, of course, discuss grief and death.
Sorry, that is mandatory with me.
Welcome to a very special live edition of the Weirdos Book Club. We have two guests with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming the writer Rick Samada, journalist and author of the Sunday Times bestseller, I Never Said I Loved You, a memoir that has garnered rave reviews and broken hearts. Rick's writing is, I couldn't read my own writing, I thought it said functioning. I thought that's, doesn't sound very like a compliment, does it? Rick's writing is unflinching about life's traumas, but by some alchemy also manages to be exceptionally funny. Joining him is my co-host and beloved Carriad Lloyd. After losing her father to cancer as a teenager, Carriad used her experience navigating complicated grief as the inspiration for her hugely successful and award-winning Griefcast. After interviewing a wide spectrum of people at different stages of loss on her podcast, Carriad wrote You Are Not Alone. Part grief manual, part friend to the grieving. It has garnered hundreds of five-star reviews on Amazon and launched in paperback in February. To ask you a question, both of you. I did lots of questions, but the first one, because you both, there's no denying it, write about sad things.
Yeah.
So, has there ever been a point in your life before writing, in a sad point in your life, you were made to feel better by reading about someone's sad things? Does that make sense? Have you ever read a sad book and it was helpful?
Well, for me, it's not so much, I used to be very into, which I feel like you might be, sad music. And I have a vivid memory of an Edinburgh festival where I had to stay in your flat for 2 days before my flat was ready. And I was repeatedly on a loop listening to Fiona Apple, The Idler Turns the Wheel. And you at one point came in and said, how can you fucking listen to this? And I was like, yeah, but that's the vibe. It's like, you feel terrible, she feels terrible, and then you're not alone. So I think I was always into like the feeling you have inside, you want someone, I'm not into that like, oh, cheer up vibes.
Yeah.
I don't feel that so much.
And so that process is being kept company in the emotions that you are feeling.
Yeah, just feeling like, I don't know, it's nice to have someone be like, yeah, me too. Whereas when if that kind of forced cheeriness, I find that really jarring of like, but I don't feel like that. I can't join in.
So when I was trying to put on the Black Eyed Peas, tonight's going to be a good night. That's why it wasn't appropriate.
I appreciated it. I definitely appreciate it. But I would never choose to be like, oh, I'm going to put on. I do now. I've got better.
No, I agree. Yes, up. Sad songs are just my comfort place.
Yeah, nice.
And I don't know if you can relate to this. I definitely relate to the that thing of sad music when I was very young. And actually, because we're here to talk about grief, I guess, there was a weird sense, I don't know if you had this, where grief was like a sort of an alibi for the sadness I already felt.
Yes.
I remember when I was young listening to a lot of sad music. Like, yeah. I remember Evita, the soundtrack to Evita, and Another Suitcase in Another Hall, and feeling like the pain of that woman who was never at home. And she was like high flying adored, but you know, no one saw her. And I felt all of that and this like this tragic resonance before anything bad had happened to me.
Yeah.
And then loads of bad things did happen to me. And that was sort of a relief in a weird way. Because at least there was an alibi.
With Joni Mitchell, that was my like, and that Blue album. And that was before my dad died. And I would just listen to this woman who'd like, yeah, had this, you know, Californian heartbreak, but given a child away. And I'd be like, yeah, I feel you, Joni. In North London suburbs, I feel you. And
you know, she's just come back on Spotify because of, is it the Joe Rogan dispute?
Did she take herself
protest,
off for that?
Yes, to protest Joe Rogan's
It's very hard if you make a really big point about boycotting something and then decide, hang on.
Yeah.
And then you have to backtrack again.
But it was very funny. All of my, I've got this sort of male friendship WhatsApp group. And we call it the girls. It's a picture of Sex and the City with like, but it's just me, Chris and Tom. Yeah. And the girls. And we got very excited when Blue by Joni Mitchell came back on Spotify. It was a big day on the group that day. Like, lads, she's back. Let's get sad.
I didn't know she'd gone. But I'm excited to know she's back. That's nice.
She'll be delighted to hear that.
Yeah, she will be. Well,
so,
I guess
so. Listening to sad music, but never sort of wanting to read. You've never read books that are like your books.
Oh, that's a good question.
So, like The Year of Magical Thinking. That's a very famous sort of.
That's a famous griefy book.
Grief memoir.
She does her grief.
Have either of you read that book?
No.
I was like, who's going to admit it? No, it's on my list. It's on the list.
Yeah, it's on the list.
Yeah. I had to read loads of grief books for the podcast when I was doing the podcast. And then when I got the book deal, I found that I had to stop reading them because then obviously instantly you're like, oh, well, they've said this thing about grief and you just don't want it to come up in your writing and be like, oh, I accidentally. And also with grief, the metaphors are limited. There's like, you know what I mean? Like there's lots of familiar metaphors, waves and like nature is used and all that sort of stuff. So
Did you find yourself trying to avoid, like in the interest of not being cliche, trying to avoid the sort of those metaphors that do feel true and eternal and abiding?
I would just put them in and be like, I know it's a cliche, but it's true. Because I think sometimes with grief, especially when you're writing about grief, that universal language thing is really important to kind of get someone sometimes to even want to start reading about it because people are so afraid. If you're not in the sad music club, sometimes people are like, oh, I don't want to think about this.
Or even if they're listening to sad music, you're going, hey, turn it off.
It's
time to read.
Yeah, it's time to read about the sadness.
Yeah.
That's how I know when I'm feeling very depressed is that I can't or shouldn't listen to the sad music that I love. Ooh, if I'm okay, it's fine and I love it. Yeah. But when I'm in a bad place...
Yeah,
that's when Black Eyed Peas comes on.
That's when the Black Eyed Peas comes on, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you're like that with music, aren't you? You don't like it. You don't like it.
quick, moving on.
It's too noisy. So Rick, when you were pitching your book, did you pitch it or did you write it first and then show people?
I was approached to do it after I wrote an article... about a Christmas that changed me. And I didn't want to write the article. They said, do you want to write about a Christmas that changed you? I said, I don't. If I did, I'm very lazy. If I did, it would be this story about how I woke up on my 30th birthday in a sex hotel room in Bangkok with my mother. Mm. But I can't write that. And they said, you have to write that. So I did.
Yeah, absolutely. And, everyone needs to know. Yeah.
And then that, I guess, did quite well online. I got approached by different publishers. So it was quite a backwards process. And then they said, do you want to write a memoir? And I thought, again, no. But then I thought there's something, I guess I felt the pull of that challenge, but I didn't want to write it. It wasn't something I pitched saying, I want to get this out of me. It was stuff I wanted to keep inside me and not share.
Yeah.
And I tried to write a very lighthearted sort of version and it just didn't work because it wasn't the truth. I wasn't going through the middle of that pain.
Yeah.
That's why I loved your book because I could feel that tension the whole way through of like trying to like being like, no, it's fine. And then like the sad truth was like jumping out. And I related to that. I was like, yeah, it's
one of the reviews I read of your book, Rick, which I thought was so astute, was saying that you use jokes. There's so much humor, and jokes are often used to sidestep or be flippant. And your book isn't. You are very, very honest. I was wondering, because I thought, oh gosh, I wonder how it is if you're, you know, a very funny journalist, and then you pitch a book, and then they go, oh, actually, no, that's too sad. But actually, it sounds like they wanted your sadness.
They want the sadness. Well, that's the thing with a lot of, I guess, confessional writing is so popular now, and that sort of memoir form, the first person form, is very popular. We want people's pain. We want that amplification for ourselves. And actually, writers often, I think, have to protect themselves a bit from that, because even though that's being asked of them, they might not be ready for that, or they might not want to share everything about themselves.
And it's you can't turn it back. Cariad, did you feel reticence about writing about, obviously when you were interviewing people on the podcast, you shared personal details and your experience, but writing about it is different.
It's very different. So in the book, there's like chapters which are more like, oh, this is how grief works, or the five stages are bullshit. And then there's these interludes between, which are like memories of my grief. And I'd written some of the interludes, and I think I did that thing, which I do a lot, where I didn't think past giving it to a proposal. So I was like, oh, I have to write a proposal to get this book. Here you go, here's the thing. And then they were like, now write it. And I was like, oh, I don't want to go back over those things. It was like you showed someone a bit of a diary and you were like, you know, sometimes you show a friend something and you just want them to go, that's good. And you go, great, I'll never have to speak of that ever again. And I found writing my grief journey really, really hard, because I had to go back to like being 15, and I had to like really delve into like deep past memories of like, where was I and what was I wearing when I found out he was dying and all of that stuff. And I found visiting that part of me really difficult, because you sort of can't hide, like you can't put a joke in that memory, and you can't, whereas with the chapters which were like, oh, this is how the Victorians did grief, it was like, you can put some jokes in and you can be very researching and you can feel very distanced from that emotion.
I loved your book. I thought it's so raw but so beautiful and so funny and warm. It's like a hug. And there were so many brilliant points that really sort of brought me up short, made me really think. And well, there's one thing where you talk about, it's important to say, what was your person's name? Who were they?
Yeah.
But then there's another point where you say, I think you say something like, who were you when they died?
Yeah, there's a whole chapter on like the context of who you are when a grief happens. Because I think if you don't take that into context, it can be very easy to think, oh, well, why am I grieving like that? Whereas as soon as I realize my grief began as a teenager, and that is the fundamental defining moment of my character in this narrative, is that a really terrible thing happened when I was 15. And I, after interviewing like 200 people, I realized that, you know, you could say to someone, oh, they'd just had a baby, or they'd just moved house, or it was the first time that they'd realized they hadn't properly had that conversation with their parents where they saw them as adults, and then they found out one of them was dying, or they got the phone call. And I think that context to the person you are when grief meets you helps you understand what your grief is trying to tell you. Because the weird thing about grief is it freezes you in time, but then you have to keep moving and you keep aging and growing away from this frozen version of yourself, and you're constantly pulled back to this version that is still in shock, is still trying to register what happened to them, whilst also trying to live a life. And I found this phrase, like delayed grief, which is, you know, a term psychiatrists use, which is like, if you have to deal with something at the time of a grief, you literally park it. So, you know, if you have to look after another parent or you have to look after children, your grief just gets parked. And I was like, oh, they're saying that like we all know that. But I don't think people do know how quick your brain is to protect you, how quick it moves things on. And how, you know, I definitely think for me, it was like, oh, I was 15. So I was in an environment where nobody could relate to what was happening to me. And also no one had the vocabulary to talk to me about it. But I was grieving. So I had to kind of completely split myself in two at that moment.
I found it so moving, that process of you trying to reconcile that rift and understand that girl, yeah.
So what you both have in common is that, and I found this quite interesting, neither of you set out on a life journey wanting to write books, exposing yourself, working through these issues in writing, but your success, you know, pushed you. You both had publishers approaching you saying, hey, now it's time to write a book. Yeah. Now it's time to sort of talk more about this. But what you also have in common, interestingly, is that you both started out your careers as actors.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Which is pretending, I don't know if you know, pretending to be someone else. It's the dictionary definition.
I loved Rick's stuff about acting. I found that a little bit too close to the bone on your book. I was like, oh, God, I've been seen. We both did start out wanting to be actors.
And so there's such a seesaw in terms of sharing.
Yeah.
If your instinct at the beginning was, I want to share by other people's writing, other people's words, pretending to be other people, exploring humanity that way, and actually you've been forced to expose yourself as well and share yourself as well. And so do you ever feel like you want to retract again and
yes.
hide away? Yes, because once you've published your books, they are out there forever. Has there ever been a point where anything in the books you've either wished wasn't in there, or you've had to adjust to other people that you maybe don't know having that information?
Well, yeah, I just think it's interesting that that's right, that we both started out as actors. And I definitely spent a long time not wanting to be me. I think that's where it came from a lot, of like, me is sad. Me is listening to Joni Mitchell surrounded by teenagers drinking Smirnoff Ice. You don't understand what grief is. It was tough. And so I wanted to hide. And then what I felt was like, I just couldn't hide. It just kept like embarrassingly being there. I think I describe in the book, it feels like wetting yourself. It's just like, there's nothing you can do. You're just pissing grief everywhere. And nobody, everyone's embarrassed for you. Sorry, that was visceral.
It's true, the pain will out.
Yeah, pain will out. And I think I was trying to hide. Like, and so then I did character comedy for ages. It was completely like, not me, not me, not me. And I feel like, I don't know, I mean, there must be a part of me that wants to sit up here and be Carrie Ad talking. There must be, because, and same, like, you end up doing it. So, but this feels like the logic argument is like, don't share this with people because they won't get it or they won't understand. And I think what happened when I started the podcast was I just reached a point where I couldn't contain it anymore. I was like, I have to talk to about my grief. But my trick to myself was, oh, I'm only going to talk about it to people in the club.
Yeah.
So I'm only going to invite people onto my podcast who are in the grief club, and then we'll talk. And then I assumed, well, the only people who listen were people who are grieving, and I didn't think there was that many of us.
Yeah.
And I found out there's loads. I was like, oh, okay, there's quite a lot of people that want this conversation.
Giving people access to your interiority is a very fraught thing, and you have to be really boundaried with it.
People always obviously tell me their grief stories pretty instantly, but I think I, through the process of doing the podcast, had developed a way of trying to have a boundary where you're not taking too much of other people's grief on. But I definitely, when I don't know how you feel, Rick, but when I was writing the book, I knew I had to just put everything in. I knew it had to be the raw pain to be a good grief book, having read so many, apart from, you know, magical thinking. So I kind of had to like not think how it would be reacted to, even though part of me was like, I don't want to say this, or I don't want to share this. But I was like, but you know you have to, otherwise what's the point of this book?
Yes, there's a piece of writing advice which I've heard and often give, which is that there's lots of people that want to write and there's a thing that they can't get past. They're like, I want to write, but I can't share this. And often that's where the gold is.
Yeah.
And you have to get over that somehow. And the trick is you say, okay, well, write it not to share, just so you've written it to go through it, and then we can take it out later. And they never take it out.
It's exactly the same with stand-up comedy, which is, if your first thought when something happens is, I hope no one ever finds out about this, you have to go and tell everyone tonight. For that exact reason, it's like, oh, there's some deep, you know, there's where humanity lives.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, you know, we're all avid readers. You know when someone is sharing with you in a book, you know when it's really truthful. And I felt that with your one, definitely. I was like, oh, I feel like Rick is talking to me. If you know what it's like to read a book that is generous enough to share really, really deep, horrible, you know, the insides of their soul. And that's how I felt with this book, was I really felt like I was writing it for 15-year-old me. I was like, I need to have, because that book didn't exist and there was no, you know, there was no social media and there was no internet. So I just had no idea what I was going through. And I was like, 15-year-old me was obviously I'm still quite a harsh critic. 15-year-old me was even worse. So I was like, it has to pass that teenage test of that girl picking it up and being like, why the fuck should I read this? And that's what I was like, well, then you have to be honest, don't you? You have to be really brutally honest of what grief is like.
If it was 15-year-old you, it's like, you have to buy it. You've dropped ash on it from your cigarette.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
While we're talking about response, because you both write about personal things, and you both have great mums, how did they respond to your books?
Oh yeah, I love your mum; she's incredible. Yeah.
I plucked up the courage to go and talk to my mum and said, "I'm thinking of writing this book, and you know, it's going to be a lot of difficult material in it. There's going to be grief and conversations we need to have, and a lot of pain and about my childhood, and you know, I'm going to write about you. You're going to be quite a big character in the book. How do you feel about that?" And she said, "Well, it's about time." Yeah, she's so encouraging and supportive, and she's really helped me through navigating that difficult thing of making yourself public and people's strange reactions and unpredictability. And she's been just this complete rock for me.
I particularly enjoy her meals that you describe in the book, and if you follow Rick on Instagram, you'll see you've been sharing recently. The meals.
Well, I've been trying not to recently because people just come up to me and they assume I live at home with my mum, which is fine, but I don't. And they always say, how's your mum? I'm like, well, I don't know. How's your mum? Weird question. I'm a middle-aged man.
Carry on.
I mean, my mum is amazing, but she's quite introverted and quite shy. But obviously behind doors, she's much more loud and loopy. And so I think for me, because the podcast came first, that was the conversation in my family of like, oh, you're going to talk about it. My brother said, oh, you still still feel the need to go on about it, do you? Like, I was like, yeah, I still feel like I want to talk about it. It was like, oh, okay. Because for him, it's like, it's not done, but he just feels completely differently. Like, he doesn't need to share it. So the podcast, the birth of that was definitely raised lots of those conversations. And then I said I was writing a book. Again, my brother was like, I need to read it first. And I had to remind him that he wouldn't be in it that much. It wasn't mainly about him. It was about dad. And my mum, she was just, we both have Essex mothers. And so Essex working class mothers. And so we were driving somewhere after it came out. And she just, without looking at me, patted me and went, it's very good. And that was, I was like, whoa, that was big. That was really big.
That's big.
That's like, you know, she threw me a party. She was very proud of it. And I think for her, though, she did say it was a very difficult read because obviously it's a complete reminder of what happened to our family. But I think she said it's very interesting because it's the perspective, I guess, that you didn't have at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the mother of these two teenage children. And you're grieving your husband. So she was like, I didn't really know what you're going through, and I feel like now you do. And I felt like, well, now I want you to write a book so I can find out how you felt.
It is an incredible thing to have that access to kind of the people closest to you and to know things that they could
They're
never
lucky,
really
aren't they?
You.
They're lucky
They're
that we've
so
done
lucky
it.
To
yeah.
Have us.
They're lucky. Yeah. They should be grateful.
Yeah. And so what about the use of humour? Is it inbuilt that you think, okay, lighten it up.
Little joke for the reader. Lighten up.
Yeah. And did you think, you know, in terms of your readers, they'll want to be entertained rather than just Joni Mitchell'd?
I went all over the place tonally. And it took me a year to sort of even do the book proposal to get the tone right.
Yeah, okay.
So I went all over the place, different versions, different drafts. And one version was so dark. It was just this kind of stream of consciousness about what it's like to be inside death anxiety or a panic attack. And it was really dense prose.
Yeah.
And my agent said, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Do you want people to read the book? And to her credit, she said, you can do this. It might reach a smaller group of people. And I thought, well, yeah. So she gave me the choice. And I thought, well, actually, I want to reach people.
Yeah.
And actually, I want to be, I'm not doing this for therapy, for me, to feel better. I actually want to do something that helps other people. It's like a sort of gift. There's some generosity in it. And I think that informed the wanting to make it funny and light in places or just use levity. I think that's something about your book as well. You're so conscious when you're in grief. I remember not being able to take in, you can take in so little when you're in that dark place. For a lot of people, it'll be Bridgerton or Jason Statham. You know, they're not going to be reading I remember reading grief literature and it was so dry, made me feel miserable, even though it was very true. And so actually a book like yours is so welcoming and accessible. I think that's part of it. What makes it beautiful is you can feel that impulse to reach out and to touch people.
Yeah, and I think, again, because I'd already had the podcast and the whole purpose of the podcast, because I felt the same, everything I encountered that was griefy was so dry and depressing and head tilty and, you know, footprints in the sand, kind of squirrely front. And I was just like, oh, that's not my... I don't feel like that. And so with the podcast, my aim was always like, I want it to be that someone grieving will listen to it. And when the hour or 50 minutes is up, they'll feel 1% better. Like, they won't feel 1% worse. That was always my aim. So, like, they would have laughed because we would always, you know, I was interviewing comedians. And because when you're grieving, like you said, there's so little let up in the pain that anything that kind of laughter that comes with grief sometimes when you're like, oh, God, yeah, me too. Oh, right, yeah, we laughed at the funeral. We laughed at the hospital bed. We're all laughing. And that's how I felt with the book, you know, and that's why I took a lot of quotes from the podcast and put them in the book as well, because I really wanted it to be that there's enough grief literature out there that is like, you know, really. Yes. Yeah. And like, but some people need them, want that, and that's great. But
and people feel so guilty about laughing when they're grieving.
So guilty, so guilty.
And you just want to say, that's fine, that's good, that's part of life. I laughed so hard on the day of my father's funeral. And you have this weird sort of guilt about it. Yeah. But actually, that's... It's not like you stop being you or life stops being life.
So many podcast listeners coming up to me going, oh, we were laughing as well at the bedside. And I'd be like, why are you whispering? Because like you've heard like 100 episodes where people have said, yeah, we laughed. And that, you know, when I started the show, I assumed it was just my family that had been cracking terrible jokes. And then when you speak to everybody is doing that because it's coping. And I write in the book as well, I have no scientific theory for this at all. But I think it's about reminding yourself you're alive. So I think that need to laugh is like you draw a lot of oxygen in when you laugh. And it's about everybody being like, we're not dead. We're not dead. They're dying, but we're not dead. And I think that's the guilt comes from that of like, we are living. Yeah. But it's also something in your brain being like, you're not going to fall into that coffin. Like, that's not what is going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think laughter is like, it's so important in grief. And yet we feel so ashamed of it. And that, after this many interviews, I was like, oh, well, we don't need to. Everyone's doing it.
One of the things that you say so clearly, Cariad, is that like grief isn't linear. And I think that's where the laughter comes in. Because laughter also doesn't mean everything's okay now, the end.
Yeah, yeah, that's
true.
It's
not like, oh, ha, 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 bye.
Yeah.
Now everything's
fine. Credit roll is fine.
It's part of the sort of winding around.
Yeah, I think that's really important to remind people that it's not remotely linear. It goes back, forwards, round, and in fact, looks very much like the cover of Rick's book in that squiggle. It's a complete fucking mess. And the laughter is, I always say to people when they're talking to me about grief, of like, if you feel bad for laughing, like, don't worry, you'll be crying in a minute. Like, you don't have to, like, the pain will find you. So if you have a brief moment where you think, oh, that was funny, I felt for 2 minutes, I felt all right, enjoy it, because grief will come back and smack you in the face later on.
Do you ever feel like a friendship with your grief?
Oh, good question. I do now. I didn't for years. I hated it. I loathed it. I was like this evil friend that had decided to follow me around.
But it's interesting because hearing you talk, and obviously I've known you this entire time.
Yeah.
But it's the community of grief that's making, has made other people feel 1% better. But also that was the problem for you, is that you didn't have enough people who understood what you were going, you didn't have that community as a teenager.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel jealous and happy that people now have so much access, which I write about in the book, like this digital community that exists for grieving now. Because when, you know, in 1998, like there was just nothing.
And you couldn't even Google, why am I sad?
You couldn't Google, why am I sad? You had to just listen to Joni Mitchell and go, well, she's sad because she gave her daughter away in the 60s. Like, but I can relate to you, Joni, even though we have very different lives. And, you know, there was nothing for anyone under 18 in terms of grief counselling. People just assumed you just get over it. And I felt, I had one friend at school, Hannah, brilliant Hannah, whose dad had died when she was 8. And we would talk about it. And then there was another girl whose dad had died, but she wouldn't talk about it. So me and Hannah tried to like bring her into the club, like, hey, dead dad club. And she was like, no, I'm not joining you two. And so we were like, oh. And that's all I had. So when people would talk about Father's Day or moan about their parents, I just had one other person. And I just, like, it wasn't until I started doing the podcast and this community opened up and I said the emails just started pouring in, like every single day from the first episode going out, of like, I felt like this, I didn't know any, and I was like, oh fuck, there's loads of us who think that we're alone, there's loads of us who think that, and we're not, that's so mad, what a mad situation where we can all just go, oh yeah, we're all going through the same thing.
But I think sadness is so isolating. I mean, depression is isolating,
and grief, as like the part of your brain that lights up when you're grieving, is the same part that lights up when you're depressed, even though grief is obviously not a mental illness, it's the same part of your brain that makes you feel no one understands, you're the only person with this pain. There's no point in talking about it because no one else can reach you, whereas actually they can.
I do have to say, the title of your book, You Are Not Alone, it's obviously lovely, but at some point a weird like perspectival shift happened where I thought, if that popped up on my phone as like a text message from a number I didn't know and it just said, you are not alone. I find it so chilling.
Well, I remember telling Sarah the title and she was like, oh, like the Michael Jackson song. And I was like, what? Because it hadn't even occurred to me. I was like, what Michael Jackson song? And then I was like, oh my God, that one. Like, I was like, how did I not think
we're
that?
The kind of friends you need around to take a beautiful thing and just pull it down.
This is it.
In writing about your own lives as you have, you mentioned like writing as therapy earlier. Did any of it make you feel better?
Mine did, definitely. I feel like I put my grief in a book. And I feel like, you know, when people say write it down and or offer that as therapy, I never really understood that. And now I feel like genuinely it's like creating another space in your brain because the pain and all the memories are stored somewhere else. And so I don't need to hold on to them as tightly as I was.
So it's externalized.
Yeah, I found it really helpful.
I think definitely the creative alchemy is true and it does changes you, and that change is sort of interesting and rich and often makes you feel better in lots of ways, but also you're just always rushing forwards in the maelstrom of life and just encountering new feelings and new losses, and I don't know, it's strange that you can't really pin down a state like, now I feel I've got over something. It's just you're always getting richer and more seasoned, and it changes your relationship to those losses and those experiences by writing about them and making them public, and you're dealing with that. So it's sort of hard to say in a kind of pat way. But yes, I guess.
I mean, I was happy for the answer to be no. Because I think it's one of those things that if you're very external, you go, oh, that person's done that for them, I hope they feel better. But as you say, it's creativity. We don't expect Joni Mitchell to release an album and then go.
I don't think Joni's ever done that.
Feeling great now.
Yeah, I did. I definitely felt like it helped me process a lot of stuff. And I definitely felt like because of the podcast, although I talked about my grief a lot, I was interviewing people and it gave me space to just actually look at my mess and be like, oh, what is this? What have I been carrying around? But you're right. It doesn't in that sentence, I don't mean I'm fine, yes, or I don't grieve him anymore at yeah. all. No, I just meant it felt like at the point that it was published, all the grief behind me was in a bit of a tidier state. I was yeah. like, oh, right. Yeah, I know where I've come from, but there's still, and there will forever in my life, as I say repeatedly in the book, like it's a lifelong process. You never get over it. You just learn to live with it.
Yes, but what you do invite in is a lot of connection. Like yeah. with the title, and when you do something, yeah. when you write something and you publish it, you invite a lot of connection. And actually that can be difficult, but also very rewarding. I think you must have had a lot of
yeah, it's double-edged, isn't it? It's very rewarding to know that it's helped in any way. But then it's also, yeah, lots of people wanting to tell you their grief stories, which is wonderful. But also you reach this like point where you're like, I can't. And I stopped doing the podcast when it came out in hardback because I was like, I can't. I just need a break from talking about it. Okay. Yeah. And then I started one called The Weirdos Book Club with Sarah Pascoe. Because I was like, I need a break from digging it up every week. That's what it felt like.
Yes, you'd slaked your grief thirst. I was worried you were so hungry for grief that you're going to start killing people. So I was like, she's obsessed with
so there'd be more mourners.
Yeah.
Turning up at funerals when she doesn't know anyone.
That's the Osmond version of it, yeah. how this plays out.
Yeah. Other comedians would message me and be like, oh, did you hear so-and-so's dad just died? And I'd be like...
Get on the blower.
Yeah, they were like, yeah. And I'd be like, I probably...
That'd be a great get. Yeah. Who's their agent?
But also...
I have to wait for them to... If they want to talk to me, they might not want to. Oh, they put it on Facebook.
But there were other people who... And this is classic comedians, by the way, in terms of how we desire attention... would have a death in the family and their first thought would be, oh, now I can do grief cast.
People have said that to me.
Yeah, people have got in contact sort of pitching themselves and Carrie's having to sort of say, wait for some stuff to sink
yeah,
in.
Yeah, why don't first. You wait? Yeah. No, yeah. Someone said, someone was like, oh, I don't have a grief, but the moment I do, I'm going to call you. No, it's like, they're like, that's my first thought. And someone did say to me, I remember seeing someone be like, oh, I'm so sorry I heard about it. They were like, no, I actually thought of you because I thought, I can come on Griefcast now. I was like, I'm not actually recording anymore. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
It's like the Bergheim. They're all just trying to get in and you're having strict door policy.
Yeah, I'm very cool.
It's the equivalent of, I say did you used to, but you might still, watching yourself cry in the mirror. Sort of being, but genuinely being sad, but also going, I wonder how I look when I'm this sad.
You used to have good stand-up about that. Do you remember? Oh, it was good. I liked it.
Do you ever do that? Used to do it?
I did once... I was trying to get some headshots done. And I thought, I'll just do it myself, because headshots are very expensive when you're an actor. And I sort of went to the graveyard. And I just sat there, I guess, like an early version of a selfie, but just a camera, like a disposable camera, taking pictures of myself. And I started to cry, because I'm just thinking about death. And then I just had this entire roll of pictures of me crying, and I had to take them to be developed. It took like a week.
Do you still have them?
I think I do, yeah.
That's an art exhibition I would go to.
It's definitely a Guardian article in there, definitely.
Oh my God, on a disposable camera. I just want to know who walked past and what they thought.
Yeah, well, who's developing those pictures?
Yeah.
Like, what are they thinking? Yeah, like, what jobs was I looking for as well?
So I wanted to ask about sort of future writing. Mm. So Rick, after writing your book, did you get approached again to like, okay, and now what's sad?
That would be a great title for the next one. Yeah. What's sad now? Oh, by Rick Smadder.
Or did you want to write something completely different, or what is your next book going to be?
I don't know. I'm definitely interested in fiction and not just taking off a layer of skin and showing the world. I want to lean into the creativity and play of language and story, and it's because it's all using yourself anyway.
Yeah.
But not having to have that sort of one-to-one relationship with it, and have people assume that it's some weird like Freudian need of mine to kind of just constantly be perceived all the time in my pain. I sort of want to do something different. So I don't know. But,
okay, yeah. Exciting. And Carriad, we all know that you had a 5-book deal for writing children's books.
I put it on Instagram, so.
So I was going to ask you, you've written this book to be a friend to grieving people, and now do you feel a responsibility to to provide a similar thing for younger people?
Yeah, I've done a picture book, which is coming out next year, which is... about grief, a very specific like grief for explaining death to children picture book. And then I'm writing what's called middle grade, which is like 8 to 12. And I pitched this like Regency, Jane Austen era, like mystery adventure. And then fucking grief turned up. Just some grief turned up in the book. So even this kid's book has some grief in it.
Well, all of the people from the Regency period are dead.
They are dead, yeah. And she realises that midway through the book. Yeah, I started writing this character, and again, it was so nice to write fiction. And I, you know, sometimes I'd hear writers say, oh, just getting to sit down at my desk and play. And I'd be like, what the, who is that? Because when you're writing memoir, I don't know how you felt, like I'd like drag myself to the desk. And I had to write this in the pandemic just after giving birth to my second child. So it was like not an easy write. And I'd have to like drag myself while Octonauts is blaring, put on noise cancelling headphones and be like, so I remember him being in the hospital and be like, this is so painful. And then be given the chance, the opportunity to write fiction for kids, it was like, oh, I see what people mean when it's fun. Like, oh, it can be fun because it's not you. You're not like ripping out bits of your heart and being like, there you go, is that good enough? You're like, oh, what would be funny for this character to do? So I don't feel too much responsibility. I feel like I've done my job with the grief. I feel like it's there. If you need any of the things I know, it's all in there. But I think it is a subject I just can't get away from. And I think whatever I write, there'll be some element of grief in it.
Yeah.
Wherever you go, that's where you are.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Which is a really great segue. You can't get away from it. Carriad, you're going to read us a couple of sections from your book. I just want everyone to know that Carrie didn't want to and said she hadn't chosen anything. But I thought it was really important because if you haven't read Carriad's book, or if you think, oh, you know, I'm sure lots of you here are at different stages of having lost somebody, you might think, well, I don't actually want to read it, or I don't want to be sad. And it's a really helpful book because it, I think, sits next to you in how messy your process is. It doesn't pretend to understand you. There are no platitudes. It's fighting against those platitudes and anyone who told you that time was going to help, or you know that by a certain number of years you're going to be coping better. And and I think these two readings are really good examples of that. So one of them is right from the beginning.
Yeah, I tried to avoid it reading out by not bringing a copy of my book. This is Rick's, and by making Sarah choose it. Anyway, so this is one of the sort of interludes that are between the chapters that are jollier. And I only say that because people always think it's a like they're like, oh, depressing. So I'm like, some of it's funny, but the interludes are not funny. Okay, so this is called Things I Don't Do Because You Died. Go hang gliding. Mum makes me promise. Go to bed in an argument. Leave without saying goodbye to everyone in case they die or I die. Take drugs. Get too drunk. Buy Father's Day cards. Take middle-aged men very seriously. Cope well when middle-aged men ignore me. Appreciate being told what to do by middle-aged men. Ring you up and ask how something works. Have my grammar corrected. Feel embarrassed by how unembarrassed you were of yourself. Argue with you, know you. Trust that everything will be fine. Some of it's cheerier, some of it's cheerier.
If Joni Mitchell said that after a song.
Do you know what she did say? Have you heard that?
We're allowed to sit with our feelings.
Oh, sorry. She's got a massive rant about Vincent van Gogh. Have you heard that run? It's on the Woodstock. She's like, no one would ask Vincent van Gogh to keep painting the sunflowers, but you keep asking me to sing this song. I was like, all right, Joni, just come on. This is from the beginning of the book, and it kind of explains.
That's such a bad analogy, because everyone goes to galleries and goes, and oh, van Gogh, it's the sunflowers. Let's look at that again.
I know. Look.
They're
She's
not
a great
in there going, has Van Gogh got any new stuff that we could have a look at? We've seen the sunflowers already.
And if Van Gogh came round your house and was like, I'm only going to show you the sunflowers, you wouldn't be like, oh, come on. Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd be happy. Yeah, well. So this, oh, I don't know. Okay, Sarah, I'm going to read this.
This is at the beginning, and I think this is the perfect page for anyone listening or in the room thinking, you know, what's it about?
Well, I'll tell you. This is a book about death. This is a book about grief. This is a book about the mess. This is a book about the complexities. This is a book about how you don't get over it. This is a book about the pain. This is a book about the loss. This is a book about how you don't get over it. This is a book about the weirdness of it all. This is a book about when you were bored at the hospital. This is a book about when you howled and wept and sobbed so loudly it sounded like a goose honking, which made you laugh out loud and it stopped your tears. This is a book about how you don't get over it. This is a book about how it can affect you even if you haven't seen them for years. This is a book about how we don't talk about it. This is a book about how you don't get over it. This is a book about how you worried what to wear to the funeral. This is a book about how you know they waited for you to get there. This is a book about how you just left the room for a second and they went. This is a book about how you don't get over it. This is a book about how there's no right way to do this. This is a book about letting go of the shame of doing this wrong. This is a book about death. This is a book about grief. This is a book to say again and again, you are not alone.
You are not alone.
I couldn't hold
it. I nearly said that. I nearly said that and I thought, no, Sarah will tell me off for like letting us sit with her feelings. So I'm not going to sing You Are Not Alone. So I'm proud of myself. Thank you for sharing that joke, Rick. Thank you.
But I'm also crying. See, I'm trying to evade my own feelings.
This is the wonderful thing about very funny people writing very vulnerably is it is incredibly moving. And of course you don't want to read any of it out because you wrote it down so that you didn't have to be there.
Yes.
When you told people about it. So thank you so much, all of you, for coming. Would you give a big round of applause to Carrie Adloyd and Rick Salander?
Thank you. And Sarah Pascoe.
And Sarah.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club.
Rick's book, I Never Said I Love You, is available to buy now.
My novel, Weirdo, and Carriad's book, You Are Not Alone, as you may have guessed, are out in paperback and available to get in all good bookshops.
You can find out all about our upcoming books we're going to be discussing on our Instagram at Sarah and Carriad's Weirdos Book Club.
Thank you for reading with us.
We like reading with you.
And remember, you're not alone.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and it might be, I probably don't want to sound, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But this one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.